Welcome, everyone. This is, what is it, episode 7 of Coffee with Centuro. Good morning, morning.
Morning.
My colleagues Zane and Ben, welcome to nice. Is that a new cup there you have, Zane?
I do.
You're trying to make a...
Information, yes, you know.
It's a cool. So if you haven't watched one of these episodes, it's just the three of us talking a bit about business. It's our take on business for the week. It's nothing serious. It's fun. We see what learnings we can pull out of it. So I wanted to jump straight into it with you guys. I have done this in previous episodes as well, where we've spoken about the super rich. I don't know why I'm fixated on it, but I saw that Chuck Feeney. He came up. He kind of invented, or him and his partner started the duty free shopping. He became a multi-billionaire, and he has no more money left. He's pretty much broke, but because he's given it all away to charity. So that was his whole philosophy, and he's wanted to give all of his wealth away while he was still alive. And guess what? He succeeded. So he's actually all the way down to pretty much broke now after being a billionaire. But that's what he wanted. He's an old man, and that's what he's done. What do you guys think of this new trend within philanthropy, where it's kind of giving your wealth while you're still alive? Not a problem I have that I have to deal with right now, I must tell you. But I'm just saying, we still have a few years to go.
Yeah, I think that's what it should all be about anyway. I mean, what's the point of having billions? I mean, what you can live a very comfortable life with a lot less than that. And I don't know the statistics, but you know, they say something like the 1% richest people in the world have more money than the other 99%. And there's so many people in poverty, you don't even have access to clean water, so many issues in the world. I mean, if you've got that much money, I mean, again, it's kind of nuanced. So I think we've discussed this previously. Just because Bezos is worth 180 billion doesn't mean he has 180 billion in his bank account. But nonetheless, if you accumulate that level of wealth, I think it should be about, you know, giving back.
Yeah, I'd be interested to see how much he left himself with, because I think Mark Zuckerberg's been on record and a number of other guys for a similar thing, where it's like, I'm going to give away 99%. And I think it worked out that he's going to keep 500 million, you know, just a little cache of 500 million in the back pocket and give away the rest. And that would then become his generational wealth, essentially, I guess, like that would keep his kids and his kids, you know, sorted for life. So it'd be interesting if he has gone properly broke, or not broke. I imagine he's got something, but is he sitting in the, I've just left myself a pot of 100 million, or is he properly down to like, I've got a couple hundred. Yeah.
And go and beg from some of his buddies. I mean, there's something called the giving pledge. And it's something where I think it was started by Bill Gates and Melinda Gates. It's called the Giving Pledge, and it's where you pledge to give away half of your wealth. So yeah. Mackenzie Scott, richest woman in the world, and I know we spoke about her before, and I think in kind of reflection, I wondered if we're being derogatory by the fact that we couldn't remember her name, and I couldn't, but it's Jeff Bezos's ex-wife, Mackenzie Scott, is now officially the richest woman in the world. And she did make it out of her shares of Amazon, right? And then I kind of thought, okay, she kind of made it out of divorce. But if you look at the other people that she's just pipped as the richest woman, they made it by inheriting it from their parents. So what's the difference, right?
Yeah.
And maybe she had to kind of withstand, and she was there as a support to Jeff Bezos when he was starting it, raising their four kids. And he would never be able to get where he was if it wasn't for her. So good. That's definitely worth the $68 billion that she has.
Yeah. The only thing I also think when you hear like, oh, we're going to give out my $50 billion to charity, I'm always just then curious of how does that money get injected into the charity system and where does it go? Like that... If these billionaires all do go and give this much money away, where is it going? And like, it'd be really interesting to see what it's then fixing. Because
there's an entire industry, right?
Yeah, but then like if you in like if you gave someone $1 billion, they could achieve so much. So like, is it happening? Because if I wonder if they're focusing it in on one particular sort of problem, or are they spreading it out? Is it going into research for cancer?
Thank you for leading to my next point, which is this is what she's so Mackenzie Scott recently gave away $1.7 billion, and she and I've got a list here on my screen, but it's not just one thing. It's 10 charities that she's chosen. Whether it's racial, there's $500 million to racial equality, LGBTQ, 46 million, gender equity, 133 million. You know, there's the functional democracy, 72 million. So they definitely choose their charities very wisely. And then one of the other hats I wear here in South Africa is that I was actually did some work for a charity that was funded by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation. And it's very strict. So they have very strict reporting to the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation on how they're spending their money. And so I don't think it's frivolous, and it's really is. Their whole one is education based, and it's doing amazing stuff here in Africa.
Yeah, I think that's always one of the concerns people have with charity. Like, where does the money actually end up? How is it spent? And there's so many different organizations. And, you know, let's say you go into developing regions rather than within the US, for example, with Mackenzie Scott. Because you're so far away, you don't know, is this actually getting to the people that need it? Are there levels of corruption within charities or governments? So yeah, there's a whole host of issues and due diligence. And I guess that's probably why Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation have put these strict criteria in place, yeah, you know, to kind of make sure it gets to the people who need it.
Yeah. And then last thing on this point before I move on, Jeff Bezos is firstly the richest man in the world and the only one of the top five richest people in America who hasn't signed the giving pledge. He's taken quite a lot of flack because he falls really short of his charitable work. He's just not giving it away. So it's interesting how he just hasn't volunteered and he's the richest guy in the world.
It's probably anyway. Then runs into that argument of I'll give it away later. I need it to make more. It's better if I make more money now and then I'll have more to give away later.
It's interesting. There's ways of spinning it. All right, moving on to the next topic. This is interesting, is that I'm not sure if you've heard, I think it was 2 years ago, a Uber car with a driver in it, a self-driving Uber car, knocked down someone and killed him. And this week, the driver, and they call him a backup driver because he's sitting in the seat, but it's a self-driving car, has been charged with negligent homicide. I raise this because I want to get your take on this particular thing, but then also, what are the other things that we are going to deal with as AI, automation, and everything else comes? Who do you sue when your self-driving car knocks someone down?
Yeah, there's a big debate around that. I think when that first happened, this was a couple of years ago, I think I vaguely remember there was some talk of, you know, the car manufacturer should be liable. But then a lot of people campaigned against that, saying, oh, you know, that stifles innovation and you're going to stop people trying to do these things because they're too worried about lawsuits. But then if you're sat in a self-driving car, not driving, is it really your fault? I mean, I guess you need to be aware that I don't know how these things work. How quickly can you take control? How quickly can you think, oh, there's a person in the road, like I have to do this? By then, you've probably already hit them.
It's a difficult one. I'm slightly of an... of a sense of you can't, I think like Zane said, you can't restrict them in such a way of saying, well, yeah, the car manufacturer is going to have to take it on board because you'll never get the technology there. And there's a lot of people like Elon Musk has even gone on record of like, it wouldn't matter a car, the self-driving car can be 99% safer than a human and people will still have an issue. You have to get it to like 99.9999% safe before people will actually hand over their trust. Even because in theory, even if it's twice as good as a person, you'd save half as many lives or whatever, right? But it's not, that won't be good enough for people to convert over. So I think it's a dangerous territory to start then suing the car manufacturers and so forth, because you'll potentially then stifle that and not make it worth their while, when it could in the big picture. end up saving a lot of lives from all the accidents it prevents.
Yeah, as far as I know, it's a lot safer than any driver. All right, and because it's taking so many points in, and here's it's a philosophical and a business decision is, if the car is seeing things and two people step into the road and one is a lady with a pram and the other one is an old man, how is the car going to decide which one to hit?
It's the train.
Someone has to type it into the computer to say, if this ever happens, knock the old guy. I don't know. I don't want to be the person typing that command into a computer.
Yeah. Well, I think that's the other issue with this. It comes down to psychology and control. So you think, all right, it's a lot safer to have an automated or self-driving car. But when it hits that person, nobody was in control of that. I know if I'm driving, if I accidentally do something wrong and hit that person, or I'll probably be horrified and blame myself forever. But I was in control. I know I can blame myself. When it's the car, you're like, who do I blame? What do I do? This is crazy. What are we doing? How are we allowing machines to do these things? It's the robot's fault. Let's stop this.
I
think that it might open up a whole nother. I mean, you're a lawyer, Zen. It could open up a whole nother field of litigation. It's like, how do you sue a robot? I mean, I don't know.
Maybe anyway, there should be a pot. Billionaires can set aside a pot to pay out these claims.
Yeah, there you go.
That's right. You'll have to start looking at diversifying the decision. Like, that's where things like blockchain and stuff, where it can be all open, start to come into it. And as long as you provide the people, they'll have to provide the source code at points, or like get everyone to agree on one sort of answer. So like, if all the car companies use the same code or something in, or use the same decision making, then it becomes sort of democratized on that decision. It's not, because you start going, well, Tesla's car is better than so-and-so's car, and that car hit someone. So it's like, they should have been, why weren't they? Then you start going, well, whose car actually knows the right thing to do? And
it's a minefield. It's a minefield. Sticking on the cars, Daimler have just announced that they're working on a hydrogen technology long distance truck, where it runs basically, it's not gas and diesel. It runs on hydrogen and water, but can go for 1,000 kilometers, 600 miles. And I just wanted to tie it in there. But what have you guys ever thought of having an electric car? Is it something that you would want to do? I mean, Ben, in your case, just having a car is probably an ambition, right?
No. Yeah. Based in London, I had to sell my car in Australia, so it's been a little while since I've owned one. There's no need here with the public transport. That's going to be my when I've got enough money to be having to pledge it. Then I'll buy myself a little electric sports car. Just for the bit of fun.
Have you guys ever thought of that? Is it something that you? I don't know what you drive, Zen, but do you drive electric, or you? Is it in your bucket list?
I've got a BMW 1 Series, so you know, one of the old basic ones. But as part of that, last year, BMW let me have the i8 for 48 hours for a test drive, which is obviously the hybrid electric car, and it's the first time I've ever driven a car like that before, and. It's actually quite dangerous, I thought, in the sense that I was sat out of traffic. I picked it up from the showroom. It's driving along thinking, oh, this is incredible. You know, the doors open up as you get in, start the engine. Got to some traffic lights. I was at the front of the queue. It went green. I went off. I'm like, crap, I'm at 50 miles an hour. You can't hear the engine. You don't realize the speed that you're going at, because it just goes, it's all relative. So I was like, oh, wow, because it's just so silent. That took a bit of getting used to.
Yeah, and an i8 would be my car if I had the choice.
And I think there's also the whole thing of the silence for pedestrians, right? Because I think we automatically are listening to cars approaching. It actually happened yesterday. I was dropping my kids at school, and it was a Prius, not an i8, but a Prius came behind me, and luckily, I just heard the wheels on the gravel behind me, and I was like, whoa, and I got a hell of a shock because I didn't hear the car at all. I just heard, and they were much closer than I thought. So it's these extra things.
Maybe that's where the self-driving cars though come in as well, because they can start to obviously predict, so that they start to see the pedestrians and give them a risk level of them stepping out into the street and being a threat. So even if it doesn't look like they're immediately about to, they do it. But they've also, they also analyze things like if someone flicks a cigarette butt into the street, it can see it and analyze that might be someone coming out from behind, something they can't see. So maybe there's a point where it, the car then starts making a noise if the risk level gets to a certain point, just to, just to like an alert, like I'm here noise, not like a just like a hi, I just, I'm coming around the corner.
It kind of hoots hoots automatically.
Or
you know, I can't help but, as you were talking about that, the thing that flashed in my mind was, it, as someone flicks the cigarette, it gives the car permission to knock them. That's what I, that was what's running through my head. But that, that's for
you
another.
You automatically become faster.
Yeah, exactly. So sticking with car theme, do you guys know the company that makes the most tires in the world? You want to take it? Okay, yeah. I got a Michelin, and I've got.
I would just say Goodyear is the brand that comes to mind.
Okay, it's a bit of a curveball. It's actually Lego, so it's Lego makes more tires than any other car, any other company in the world, and that's just a that. But in this weird time, they're actually opening up 120 new stores. I found that quite interesting. That Lego in this time is opening up 120 new stores. So I think they, they're doing quite fine. But this is where I wanted to bring to you is that they, their clients, which are kids, are writing into them and saying, "What are you doing about plastic?" So it's quite interesting how even the kids are writing to Lego and saying, you can't. So they're now coming up with other options of packaging. So to start off with, they are plastic, but they're cutting out all plastic packaging by the end of the year based on the kids saying that. And they're actually looking at looking at different composites for Lego itself. And I just thought about how your consumer can sometimes impact your product and how that affects business as you go along, is that there's a, the consumer's voice is so important all the way down to the actual fabric of the product.
Yeah. Well, I think it should be, right? If that's who the product's designed for. So it should suit the customer. If you start ignoring them and keep going, well, we've got to this size, we're too big to fail, we'll just keep doing what we do. That's how you eventually get overtaken by someone who answers that problem in the market of, all right, we're now like Lego, but we're environmentally friendly, and they'll get all the press for it, and they'll take a slice in your market. So you need to, I think, understand the, especially we're in not a, such a PC culture, but also like everything needs to, everyone's analyzing all these parts of businesses now in terms of, are they gender friendly, are they equal, are they environmentally friendly, what are their practices, what's their employment culture like, all these things start to become an effect. So yeah, I think it makes sense. I think it's a requirement that you have to do that.
Yeah, I think that is the case. I think that's the kind of way times have shifted now. Everything, there's a lot more emphasis on it, where even kids are being taught and educated about this from a young age, whether it's, you know, climate change, which is obviously a real serious issue, or all these other things. And even with employees now, like my sister just graduated university, and, you know, when people are looking for jobs, her and her friends, it's all about the culture, work-life balance, X, Y, Z. I mean, when I graduated and started working like a decade ago, it was all about, okay, I need to just work my socks off and, you know, impress, and I'll work till 2 a.m. It doesn't matter. Whereas kids now are like, no, I got to do yoga after work, and, you know, I got to do this.
it's the company's value proposition to their staff. Is basically what you're saying there as well. And I think I love that as a, what is your staff value proposition? Because I think that's also been ignored for way too long.
Yeah. Well, we obviously went through a phase, and I think it is slightly shifting, like especially within startups, where it was, yeah, cool, we've got free beers in the fridge and there's ping pong tables for you to play at lunch. And that was where the staff value proposition started shifting. I think we've now gone through that phase and people are starting to realize, like, oh, that's all like flashy, but is, what's the substance value? Is there, you know, people like, oh, you can take a day, a month or something to do charity work if you want, and you can, here's pods to nap in, or like work from home is obviously one of the sort of things as well. So I think people are adapting to that requirement as well.
I was lucky enough to go to Google campus in San Jose a few years ago, and they, at the time I looked at this and I was like, oh, this is so amazing, because they have everything on the campus, right? So if you come and work there, and you can service your car downstairs. They've got that. If you need to do your laundry, they even have a dentist on the campus. If you all your meals are free in the canteen. Plus, you can have dinner with your whole family once a week in the canteen. So now I looked at that and I went, "Whoa, mind blowing!" But what they're actually doing is just making sure you never leave. Why are you not here? It's like, I want to go and have dinner. No. You can have dinner, you never need to leave.
It's that age, sorry, I've got a dentist appointment. Yeah, great, he's downstairs, and just come back when you're done. Clock in, clock out.
Yeah, exactly. It is one of those weird ones where the culture can become so cool that it overtakes the practicality of it all.
Yeah.
And I wonder the new age of post-COVID and shared workspace is going to change this.
When I was applying for law firms back in the day, I was at law school looking at all the different firms. And I remember, so the one that was top of my list was Bird & Bird, just because they did sports law, media law. And I was just always thought, that's what I want to do. So when I went to the firm, they had it was a really old, kind of rundown-ish office, but they had foosball tables in all the kitchens on every floor. I was like, oh my god, this place is so cool just because of those foosball. I don't even like foosball because I'm rubbish at it. But it was just so cool because of that. And I remember I did work experience there, vacation scheme, and one of the partners just randomly knocked on the door, never met him before, and he goes, what are you doing? I was like, just doing some work. Is there anything I can help you with? He goes, yeah, you can follow me. Led me to the kitchen, and he goes, we're playing foosball, and he said, we've got a rule in this. Yeah. He goes, we've got a rule in this firm. If you lose 10-0, you have to strip naked and run around the corridors. And I was like, what? He's obviously taking the mic. He actually beat me 10-0, but obviously I did not do that.
There's no video evidence that might come out years' time. Okay.
Definitely not. But then at that firm, at 6 p.m., people would be like, why are you still here? I'm like, because I've got work to do. And they're like, no, it's 6 p.m., go home. Contrast that with some other firms I went to, I won't name them. I went there, and like you said, they had a dentist in the building. They had sleep pods, so you could sleep at the office. They had these little cocoon pods. They had a swimming pool. They had a restaurant. And when I spoke to people who were working there, they were like, yeah, I probably spend about 20 hours a day here. So I was like, I'd rather go for the less flashy office with the foosball tables where I have a life.
And you probably find that the other one, also any subordinate never leaves before their boss leaves. Mm. Which I also find, it's that's quite old school for me, is that the value is determined by how long you stay in there, not how much work you get done.
Could be sitting there watching YouTube, just waiting. Zane left yet? No. All right, next one.
I was always that guy's like, I'm out. Cheers. I've done my work. I mean, I not that I never work in the evenings or anything, but if I'm efficient enough and I have another rest of my life, that's what you got to go do, John Lewis, they own Waitrose. They made a £635 million loss, and they're not paying bonuses for the first time since 1953. And why I raise that again is, no, I wasn't working there, Ben, in 1953. I know you think I'm old, but I'm not that old. But it's just... I think that's part of the reality. I'm sure that they're not the only ones not paying bonuses this year. But there's this. Do you guys find? And I know it's slightly different in our work situations as you move up within an organization. But bonuses become an expected thing, and it's just kind of, if it's not there, you kind of already budgeted to spend it, right? But in this day and age, you should be grateful. Is that a fair thing in this day and age to kind of go, we're definitely not paying bonuses because of COVID this year? We spent it all on just surviving.
I think it probably depends on how it was set up. So if the expectation was, Ben, this is your salary, you can get... So in a previous job where I had a bonus... It was do your job and you get this. But if you hit these KPIs, then we'll give you a bonus. So if I spent the year hitting those KPIs, and then found out, well, actually now we can't give you the bonus. Then there's a bit of a well, I worked my butt off, I stayed late, I did this to get, like, that was what I pushed for. Otherwise, yeah, I could have just gone home at 5 p.m. and still done my job, still got to my expected levels, but wouldn't have necessarily gone much further. In that case, it's a bit disheartening, I guess. But then if it is a case of, hey, everyone's taking this hit to get us through, and there'll be a bonus, like, we can make up for it and so forth, then it just, I guess, depends how it's communicated and how you see the business as to whether or not you go, all right, yeah, this makes sense, I'm not going to be selfish. Like, I can see the business is trying to survive, as we all are. I've still got my job, I'm grateful for that. Let's figure it out next year, how, or the year after, how we make that up.
Yeah. And what about bonuses for, and we've had this in South Africa, in some governmental organizations and semi-governmental organizations, where you get a bonus for making less of a loss than you were meant to make. It's kind of one of those weird things, in that you're because there are businesses that make a loss. They're going through a dip, and we're making a loss. But guess what? I didn't make R100 million loss. We only made R50 million loss. Therefore, I get a bonus of R2 million. It's kind of a weird thing. But again, same to your point, Ben, if that's where your KPI is, that's what you do, right? Yeah. I've delivered on my job.
Yeah. Do you think of that, though, as a R50 million increase in revenue, though? So if based off our running costs and our incoming and outgoing, we should have lost this, but I made so much more incoming that actually our loss is only this. Are you then getting your bonus based off the increase? Is that how you made such a reduce the amount of loss, is you drove the revenue up?
Here's a classic case. The South African Airways, which is owned by the South African government, got an American CEO in, and he had bonuses to hit particular targets. And in his stay, and it was linked to profitability. And so all he did was sell all the aircraft, make a huge profit in the time that he was there, and just rent out other things and like cut routes and everything. But the sale of the aircraft was what made the profits jump. He made a stupid bonus that year, but the company was just like gutted. It was ripped apart. I mean, that's when you get that. Yeah, from a legal perspective.
The system.
Yeah. There's always an abuse of the system somewhere. Okay, I'm going all over the place, but there's actually a theme going through. Last real piece here, and we can chat about this. The company Stripe is offering a $20,000 bonus to their staff to move to less expensive cities. So they've got offices in San Francisco, New York, and another quite expensive city, but they have other cities as well, and they're saying that if you move from one place to another place, you get a $20,000 bonus, but then you take a 10% salary reduction. So I'm just kind of throwing it out there, and this has got nothing to do with the fact that I live in Cape Town and you guys are in London, I promise. I'm just putting it out there with you, with the thoughts on how do you think, is that fair that I'm moving to a cheaper city to live in and therefore I take a 10% reduction in my salary?
I guess it's relevant to your cost of living. So, or is it? I guess that is the question. So if it's market rate, essentially, if you're talking about the UK as an example, the cost of living in London, it's going to cost you far more than if you're living in even a big city like Manchester up in the north. So the cost of the housing, the cost of even food, the cost of probably a pint in a pub, the cost of everything, the transport, it's so much more. So the basic wage you need to live essentially in London is going to be higher than in Manchester. So then the salaries kind of need to reflect that. So I guess it does make sense in those relative terms if you do it proportionately.
Yeah, I guess you asked the question of, are you not doing the same work in London that you were doing in Manchester? So why is the value of your work different just based off where you're physically located? It's an interesting one. I would say if I move out of London, I'd like to have the same pay, please. I'm not taking any reductions. I'm going to keep doing the same work.
But I do think it's also got to do with it, whether I think new employees is another thing. I've employed you there, and that's your salary, and it's market related. But if you are moving out, but how does the new age of working from home affect this? So if you had let's say you were hired with a salary and an office in Canary Wharf, and guess what? We're now going to work home based because of COVID, and it's cool and we can work from home. Does your salary come down now because I don't need the office space?
Well, I what I've seen in some places do is they then offer a stipend of what we would have been paying for your office space. We'll give you a little bit of that to build your little home office space so you have a nicer environment, because if I was paying for you to have an environment here, I might as well pay a little bit for you to have an environment there, keep you happy, and then they reduce the cost of having an office and so forth.
It's a bit of a weird one when the employer is saying, I want you to move to a cheaper place so I can pay you a lower salary. It's like, all right, so I'm going to uplift my life and move to a different city for you to pay me less, but you're going to give me a little bit of a bonus now. How do you offset the two? It's a bit extreme.
Yeah, it is weird, because in Ben's thing, the company could go, yeah, but you're saving on transport, right? So if you think about the amount of transport you save, and so you therefore, if we reduce your salary, your take home is going to be higher because you're not paying on your transport. And then, but I get also, I think where it will come into it is moving from an expensive city to there, to move people across. When I read it, I was also, I get the bonus for the inconvenience of moving, but then it's a 10% reduction in salary as well. I thought that was a bit sneaky from Stripe. Yeah.
Yeah, I guess it depends how much you paid, because that 20,000 would then kind of cover that 10% and kind of cover, so you could get it up front. I would consider it, if like you could maybe do a little bit of the math there and just consider it. So 10% of my wage, the 20,000 would cover me for 4 years of that, say 10%. So I basically just got a 4 year advance on 10% of my salary. If I then invested that 20 grand and into some dividends, that could start generating a little bit of money over the 4 years and start building that up. You could try and think about it in those terms as well, and then see how much you could get it to. You wouldn't get it to replace the, but people might use it for a house deposit. Like, there could be benefits to it that outweigh the 10% of your salary by getting it in advance. Yeah.
Yeah, I wonder if that's a bonus to them besides the moving costs, right? Because companies pay massive amounts to move people around the world. We know that. We deal with that all the time. And I worked for Shell and I moved from Cape Town just in South Africa to Durban, and I stayed there for 3 years and I moved back. But with each move, it was actually really beneficial for me, because they paid for my house, because I bought a place there, and there's, you call it stamp duty. They paid the stamp duty and the inconvenience. They put me up in a hotel for a month. They transported all my furniture. There was actually a massive benefit to both moves. I took a step every time I moved because of the pay you almost for the inconvenience of moving. Okay. Gents, I think we're about on time. I know a little bit weird and all over the place, but I hope you enjoyed it.
I enjoyed the running thread and passing from one thing to another. It all overlapped well.
Good. And again, guys, those of you watching, if you enjoy it, give us a share. If you want to tell us what you think and what you want us to talk about, if you want to join the program and come and chat with us, let us know. We're having a lot of fun and we're sharing it. So thanks for your time. Thanks, everyone.
Thanks.
Thanks, everyone. See you guys.